This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia, on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Hello and welcome to Word for Word. Dean Beck with you across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and Sue Wilkinson is not here. Zoe Hart is joining me as co-host.
Australia's most renowned contemporary gay artist has come a long way since growing up in Brisbane, and after graduating from Queensland College of the Arts, it was an invitation to exhibit his first solo show in St Kilda's Ackland Street Gallery that led to a full-time career as an artist in Melbourne. Well, that was back in 1984.
An international leader in contemporary realism, his paintings have been included in collections from Switzerland to the UK, the USA, and countless collections here in Australia. He paints subjects from footballers to pop stars, porn stars to High Court judges, and his works hang in the National Gallery of Victoria and the National Gallery of Australia.
His works are sought after by celebrities throughout the world, and his commissioned pieces are commanding higher prices than ever before. And his art is now the subject of a stunning new book by German publishing house Bruno Gunder.
Simply titled, Untitled, Ross Watson, the book is soon to be launched here in Melbourne, and it superbly illustrates his illustrious career as one of Australia's finest artists. It's my great pleasure to present Word for Word. Ross Watson, welcome.
Good afternoon, Dean and Zoe. How are you?
Good.
What an amazing career you've had. Did you ever think that you would go from Brisbane to travelling the world with your art?
Well, I first went to Europe when I was 18. I remember I'd worked at three little jobs for a couple of years and saved. And I remember I had my, my 18th birthday when I was in Venice. So that was my first taste of travelling and
nice.
Taste of Europe. And, you know, when I got back to Brisbane, I knew that, I wanted to move to a larger city, and I ended up moving to Melbourne, you know, quite early, early on. So that was the beginning. And I've gone back to Europe virtually every year since then. So, you know, it's about 30 years ago. So... That was the start.
What got under your skin when you first went to Europe? What were the first kind of visceral experiences? And I think about somewhere like Florence, for instance, where you walk down the street for about 2 hours and then have to look at the pavement because of the overload, beauty overload. I don't know what else you'd call it. But what was it that got under your skin?
Well, I virtually lived in the museums, whether it was the Louvre or if I was... You know, eventually got down to Athens, and so spending day after day in the National Gallery there, looking at antiquities, and so that was incredibly influential, as you can imagine.
And back then, I mean, you weren't able to necessarily make the living out of art that you're fortuitously able to do now.
So what
was supporting you back then as an artist in your artist's life, being able to do that?
I lived much more simply. And I remember, I think I was 25 when I started, you know, I was able to sort of live from it properly,
and
better than
In fact, that's when Sir Elton John purchased one of your paintings.
It was
25.
I think
that would have helped.
25, 26.
Did that?
Yeah, well, it was very helpful.
Catapult you into a different league.
Well, it was certainly helpful in terms of media coverage, because you know, the media love to write about celebrities, whoever they are, and of course yeah. Elton has a great history with collecting art and photography, more particularly in the last sort of decade. Mm. But that was very helpful.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah, no, he's been fantastic. And then more recently, with he arranged for Jake Shears to model, and a lot to be grateful for.
Mm.
Yeah,
it's a hard life, I'm sure. You know, having to do all these fantastic realism pieces on old porn stars and beautiful bodies that you get to paint. You know,
it's my partner Stephen Morgan that has the tough time. You see, because I'm with the modeling sessions, I'm having to concentrate on every little detail, and so Stephen has. A somewhat more relaxing job where he just sort of
enjoys the view.
That's right, enjoys the view.
I was about to say, which part of concentrating on every little bit of detail?
That's right. Well, he's concentrating on, should he wear white Speedos next, or should he take the Speedos off?
Yeah.
The left or the right?
Well, every good photographer needs a good stylist, so.
Absolutely.
Ross, it's a long way from being a kind of talented kid at high school doing art to forging a career that is sustainable, that feeds you, houses you, and looks after you. That journey, the university is included in that journey, but how do you get to one person? Because it's all about you. And your art, and now your partner Stephen helps manage you, but unless you're putting it out there, it doesn't happen. How do you make a career out of art?
Well, I guess it takes a number of things, but I don't know. I think it's like anyone's career. There are stepping stones, and hopefully you achieve a little bit each year, and it builds and it builds. You know, as with everyone's career, that there have been moments that have been incredibly difficult and frustrating and disappointing. And I think if you have the attitude of, you kind of lose some, you win others. Well, that's the best way to go. But commercial galleries represented my work for many years, up until about 10 years ago, in Sydney and Los Angeles and London and Melbourne, Brisbane. And I often felt frustrated that, saying to my Sydney dealer, have you had the curators in from the Art Gallery of New South Wales or the National Gallery? And, oh, it's so difficult to get them in. And within a year or two of me leaving all the commercial galleries and opening my own gallery in Melbourne, and simply by sending images and material to the museums, after that, the National Gallery, Canberra, National Gallery, Victoria, and then more recently, the National Portrait Gallery have all acquired work. So,
oh, fantastic.
It's about putting it out there, isn't it?
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's right. And, a friend of Stephen of mine said more recently, he'd heard people speak about me saying, oh, well, he's very self-promoting, was the term that was used.
God forbid we tell anyone about the work that's being created.
Yeah, and, as our friend said to those people, well, unless he does, he wouldn't have the sort of profile. And I think it's a cultural thing. Like, whenever we're in the States, and Stephen and I were in the States recently, the Americans are fantastic with congratulating anyone who's, achieving something. It is something that I think for some Australians, it's easier to just say, take a bit of a shot at someone who's...
That tall poppy syndrome.
It is, I think. Mm. Yeah, it's still here. And
but any good business is about promoting that business. And when the business is you as an artist, unless you've got an agent doing it, and as you probably found out in some ways, that's never going to be as good as you taking ownership of that.
Mm. That's right. And that's why Stephen, it's one of the things that he does so well.
Mm.
Yeah, is it hard working with your partner in that regard?
Oh, I'm sure he'd say at times it is. But Yeah, because I think for any couple who are living together as well as working together, there are times that are challenging, but thankfully we manage very well. Some of the overseas trips and exhibitions have been fairly, you know, there's been days that have been quite stressful. I think the first London exhibition, there were, you know, a couple of problems that had to be sorted out quite quickly with, you know, customs and things. We're kind of learning as we went along, didn't we?
Is he good at his job?
Well, I'd like to think so.
You've still got it, so you must be all right.
Yeah, true. And, I mean, are the boundaries pretty clear? Does that help to, you know, like, this is your job and this is my job? And how do you kind of minimise the tensions that inevitably kind of happen, you know, between when shut-off time for work and when, you know, it must be a hard thing.
Well, it's you really don't switch off. It's sort of the gallery gets quite all-consuming, which is fantastic. And it means that we're often working collaboratively, so we're always working as a team. We'll check each other's work, go back but it is enjoyable.
Yeah, and what about time out from each other? Is that an essential part of making it work, or does that not actually...
Yeah, no, that's, doesn't matter. That's important. We both recognise that. I mean, we were due to both join friends last night for dinner, and Stephen got a call from his brothers, who he rarely goes out with, so I said, you know, go for it, you know, and so we ended up having the evening apart. But that's, I think, so valuable because otherwise there's always, I think, for any couple, you can end up taking each other for granted just a little bit if you're together absolutely all the time.
Mm.
Is it a case of the sum of the two parts is a much greater end result?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, what are the benefits that you've... Because a lot of artists work by themselves, promoting themselves, you know, and not necessarily... A lot of artists don't necessarily have either the time or the expertise
and most
or the desire.
Very good at it either.
Or the desire. Yeah. They've got the artistic desire to create and to be in that mode of creation. And yet you need someone who's actually doing the deadline stuff, don't you? You know, this is where we have to be at this time and this is what needs to be.
Yeah. So, well, that's what Stephen does a lot of very well.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what has that? What's been the benefit for you as an artist actually allowing and trusting a secondary party to do that?
Well, the benefit's been that, you know, I have even more time to spend in the studio, and you know, Stephen's dealing with whether it's the media or clients or shippers or the other things, the marketing,
and a lot of the gallery work is months, you know, up to 6 months in advance, we're working on different projects. So being able to coordinate projects in advance means that Ross can paint more and get the work.
Have you ever had to say, yeah, Ross, can you hurry this one up a bit?
Very good with the whip.
Yeah. That's a different show. Create. Yeah. Yesterday, please. Yeah.
That's right. But Stephen's been doing so much in the last 2 weeks, like just preparing for, you know, a book launches next Saturday, and so, you know, I've spent most of the last week working on a final painting, which was going into that exhibition, because it's a book launch and exhibition that runs for 2 weekends from next Saturday. So Stephen's been dealing with all of the orders for the book, and you know, they've been going around the world with a couple of guys.
So have you self-published?
No, the publisher Brüner Gemunde in Berlin, and so they're looking after the distribution of the book in Europe and the United States. United States, what did they say?
70% of their market.
Yeah, which is a huge
this
huge
book.
Chunk of the market. But we're looking after the Australian.
Right, you're doing the Australian
and sales. Yes,
and distribution.
Yeah, yes, that was what we sort of agreed contractually. So
good on you.
So that's why we're excited to have a really fantastic book launch. And
it weighs a ton. It's going to cost a fortune.
2.67 kilos.
Yeah, there you go. To be precise. No, you could use it as self-defence.
The most beautiful paper, quality paper.
It is beautiful.
The reproductions are spot on. And the response so far has just been, we're over the moon.
Now, Ross, what I wanted to ask you, these are oil paintings, much of your work.
Yes.
But you do sell prints of your work as well.
That's right.
Now, is that... Is it a photograph?
It's a,
or is it a scan? Or what is it?
Prints,
right.
And it's a French method. Actually, Stephen found out gicle means to spray. And it's the latest in a printmaking technology, if you like. And there are thousands of artists around the world that are now using this, and photographers like Annie Leibovitz uses gicle prints. You just achieve every little hairline detail. It misses.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Nothing.
So is that done from a scan or from a photograph?
Each painting is photographed professionally once it's finished, and then we use that image to produce the prints.
Mm. Right.
Straight onto canvas, is it?
A canvas or a textured fine art paper.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I noticed a lot of, there's so neoclassical, the beautiful imagery that, not all of it is realism, of course, that you've worked in, but a lot of this work that's in the book just... I mean, it's the stuff that I know my father's mad about, classical painting,
right.
and having gone through the Louvre and other places like that,
yes.
We're always kind of torn. We're here, I love the very realistic, beautiful paintings, but at the same time, there's always another... I want to get away from the guilt and maybe move to, I love the imagery, but, they always seem so depressing.
Right.
And the one thing I love, I really feel like I can touch the images in this and how you manage to bring the two worlds together, to say, you've got a painting, an oil painting in a kind of classical style of a footballer with a horse in the background with a beauty, it's very hard to describe. I mean, paintings are awful to describe on radio,
yeah.
But what are your influences? What is it that goes into your mind of how you blend those two? Because it works. It works. I don't know what it is, but there's some sensual parts in there of
the masters.
Past yeah. And masters,
and,
great
and
masters.
And the contemporary master.
Mm, yeah.
Well, sometimes it's been as simple as the... I've been interested in the emotional content, if you like, of the... So the contemporary model and then the figure that I've taken from... whether it's I'm referring to one of Vermeer's paintings or and they both appear to have the same emotional kind of feeling or state, so they're mirroring each other, if you like, which of course causes you to think, people in the 16th century were capable of feeling melancholy just as people are today, but what you also consider the incredible changes that have happened over three centuries, and you just look at the last 5 years in terms of contemporary technology and science and the information or the facts that science now affords us in terms of what we know about sexuality that terms of what many religions would like us to continue thinking about such subjects. So they're just some of the themes that my work has explored for years, but there are actually I think, what is it, Stephen, 10 or 12 different chapters in the book, and some of them, like you're looking at now, Dean, is from the series which was inspired by some time that I spent on a tiny island in Fiji about 15 years ago called Vatalele, and so that imagery of course has nothing to do with Europe.
Yes.
And then there was a more recent series when after Stephen and I went up looking at Aboriginal art in...
the Kimberley.
Yeah, in the Kimberley, that inspired that series, which was called Introduced Species. So there, the book begins and ends with the recent master paintings which I made featuring Matthew Mitchum and Francois Sagat, Marco da Silva... And some of those paintings, we've blown them up so that they're actually life size, like the actual size of the portraits in the painting. So they look spectacular as these double pages. So, those major paintings were the feature paintings in the recent Gay Games exhibition in Cologne that we had.
We'll come back and speak to Ross Watson a little further about what he got up to at his recent exhibition in Germany, and we'll explore his new book untitled Ross Watson a little further. You're with Dean Beck and Zoe Hart. This is Word for Word.
On the Community Radio Network from Melbourne's Joy 94.9, this is Word for Word.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Word for Word with Dean Beck and Zoe Hart. And our guest is Ross Watson. He is one of Australia's finest artists, specialising in photorealism. Now, I called it contemporary realism earlier, and I'm pleased to say that in his book it's referred to as photorealism, because that's what I knew it as. And I thought, oh, God, I don't want to bugger this up. Anyway, he has exhibited in London, Berlin, Los Angeles, and throughout Australia. And he has got a new book out called Untitled, Ross Watson. Ross, these exhibitions that you do overseas must take a lot of coordinating, and but it has to be about marketing you on an international scale. How did your Berlin show go recently?
Well, the recent show was Cologne.
Oh, Cologne, sorry. Part of the Gay Games, wasn't it?
Previous year, you're right, was Berlin. So we,
so they knew you actually in Germany.
Yeah, well, true. With some Germans had learned about my work, but I mean, actually, the German GLBTI media have sort of been running editorials on my work for probably close to 20 years now. So there's like magazines like Mate and Manner Aktuell and many of those, I mean, they've run 6 or 8 page full-colour portfolios. So, and over there, they actually send you a royalty check for running them, you know, for using them. Which,
isn't that lovely?
Which doesn't happen in every country in the world. So really, many Europeans have a very different attitude to art and artists, and it's generally a more, even more enthusiastic or respectful one than some other countries. But so I'm very grateful for that. But getting back to the exhibitions, there's a lot of logistical problems that have to be sorted out, and Stephen does a great job with that.
German customs would have to be one of the most particular countries to get any work into.
It's an oil painting. What's the problem?
every work has to be categorised with a photograph, dimensions, frame dimensions, unframed dimensions, and that's each individual item in a print folio.
Is that because they're still trying to trace back some of the images that may be coming in and out from the Nazi Germany collection disappeared?
It's really just, I think,
what's the purpose?
Friends of ours in Germany have said since reunification and the enormous cost through reunification in Germany, they've the government, the authorities have really toughened up with every euro they can collect tax.
Right.
They're not missing.
So you get charged for each of these processes of photography and categorising.
Absolutely everything in process. The crate, and as Stephen said, even if it was an unframed edition print, whereas British Customs, when we've had several exhibitions in London, one which was part of EuroPride Festival, and British Customs, our paperwork was listed as a folio of unframed prints, no question,
right,
just
and
went
that was
straight
it.
Through. Whereas the Germans wanted every unframed edition print listed with a colour photograph.
What happens to those colour photos? I mean, IP must be a bit of a nightmare these days, as far as...
I think Ross has the advantage in that his works are more valuable if it's got his signature on it. And that's always hand-signed, as opposed to, they can be reproduced on the internet or in media, but they have their most value when they're signed.
Yeah. And Zoe, when these original artworks are valued up to $33,000 and you're doing an exhibition full of them, there's a bit of money in that crate, I would have thought. So you'd want your insurance
absolutely
pretty much covered.
Yeah, absolutely. You want it covered at one end, but to be charged as the artist for bringing your own work into another country, that seems...
Oh, love, it's a tax write-off. Oh, what are you worried
about?
Oh,
no. Oh, no.
But look, all of this
hard work,
thankfully, and these challenges paid off because the Cologne exhibition had... what do we have? 2,000?
900 and something through.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
In a week.
Yes.
Wow.
But we thought it would be very busy because of the gay games, and we wouldn't have gone ahead if the gay games wasn't... It wasn't part of the gay games, if you like. But we had probably, 30% of guys from the Netherlands, had a lot of French, British. We even had some Melbourne guys into the exhibition who'd never been into the Melbourne exhibitions that we met for the first time. And, of course, the great thing is that we get to meet everybody that comes into the shows. You know, if my work was represented by a commercial gallery...
You wouldn't be there all the time.
You don't meet. And in fact, a lot of the commercial galleries, they go out of their way to keep the artists and the clients separate.
Really?
Oh, yes, because they don't want to,
to be cut
potentially
out
losing their 50% commission that they take on sales, you see. So we met a lot of wonderful people that week, didn't we? Mm-hmm.
Including the Australian ambassador to Germany who came in to support the exhibition.
Oh, great.
I've seen Ross's work before. And
Peter Tetsch, he was wonderful. He'd apparently seen my work in a number of friends' homes, and so it was his first opportunity to see the paintings in the flesh. Mm. And then he offered to write to the Consul General in New York because we were flying on to New York after we were in Europe to look at venues for a future exhibition in New York. And then my patron lives in New York, so we're catching up with him. But we did have a meeting with the Consul General, which was a lot of fun.
Now, we were talking earlier about artists having issues generally about marketing their work. Mm. How does an artist, one, let go of their work, that's always thrown out there, but also value their work? It's a nice picture, but what makes it worth $33,000?
Well, for example, recently the painting of Matthew Mitchum, which has gone to the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra, they... employed two independent valuers, which are approved by the government and so forth. And they one valuation, what came in at $45,000, and one came in at $43,000. Mm. So they went
pretty
for,
close.
Went for the $44,000
right.
split.
Okay.
To the center. So there are valuers. But
there are people that do that.
But I can also add that for all artists, I mean, when you... When an artist's career is beginning, a gallery that represents them will sort of set a price for their works. And then, you know, over the years, it would depend on how well the artist's work is selling. Obviously, if an artist's work is selling out, well, then that you've got a lot of people that are waiting for work. So that's when prices can move up. Obviously, if an artist is selling one work from a show, well, there's less chance of that. And then prices are also governed by if museums start collecting an artist's work, the media attention, editorial and reviews, and that's also a factor which comes into account.
Ross,
so there's a combination of all of those.
When you look back at a painting you did 15 years ago, and you look at the work you're doing now.
Yeah.
Are you really critical of that piece 15 years ago? Is it? Do you feel it? Do you feel you've developed? Is it clumsy? How do you look at it and see it? Or is it just a moment in time that you were doing your best then and you're doing your best now?
Well, we actually unwrapped some earlier works which have been in storage for a number of years, and we're going to include them in the book launch exhibition, which opens next Saturday. And one of those is from all the series where I was obsessed with planes and 747s and jet fighters and so forth. And these have remained, well, the paintings that will be in the exhibition have been in my own collection, so I've kept those. But looking at them afresh, it, I don't know, I mean, it was just wonderful and interesting for me to look at them afresh after, you know, not paying any attention to them for many years. And of course, you get, you know, get a sense of, well, look at, you know, what I'm working with now, what I'm interested in now, and how completely different that is to 15 years ago. But
because your work back then was often compared to Jeffrey Smart in its shapes and its colours and its vibrancy and subject matter and that sort of stuff. You look at those sort of block colours, the primary colours of those older works, and then you look at the amazing tonal depth that your latest stuff has. It's a huge departure.
Thank you. Well, I think I do feel quietly confident that the recent master paintings, which are featured in this new book, are amongst the most accomplished works that I've painted.
Absolutely.
And, you know, maybe I had to, you know, I think for a lot of artists, they often don't make the most mature works until they reach their mid-career, really. You look at a lot of artists.
We're not killing you off yet. I mean, but Stephen, I mean, think of the prices then. That'll be fantastic. Yeah.
And you know, on that thinking about, you know, you talked about going to New York for having your patron there, who's you know, obviously an avid collector and supporter of your work, which is fantastic. And you being, you know, not an elderly gentleman by any stretch of the imagination, a slip of a lad, but you know that how wonderful that people are actually recognizing and acknowledging an artist before they die, and so that you can actually reinvest, I suppose, that reward and recognition that comes with your work back into your work. What are some of the things that cultivates your, or has cultivated your artist and helped you to, when it's been a tough time, when you've had that exhibition, nothing sold, you know, or one thing sold? Have you ever had that experience in your earlier years where...
I think the first exhibition, when I was... 22 or something, there was a gallery in Ackland Street at that time in St Kilda. I think one or two or maybe three works sold in the fortnight. But, you know, I think at that time I was probably reasonably happy. I think I was excited that I'd had an exhibition.
Yeah.
So
what would you say, I suppose, to artists who are out there who think, yeah, look, my work is good and I do love doing what I'm doing. But, you know, they say, you know, art for art's sake, you know, which I would always say, well, money for Christ's sake. You know, that as artists, you know, this the whole aspect of, oh, well, you love what you do, so therefore, you know, what, you want to make a real job out of it? You know, as if being an artist doesn't have I suppose the weight of being
the financial return.
Yeah, of being being a real career. So, I mean, culturally we need to shift that mode to see, you know, that artists create a culture and, okay, lawyers might create a legal system and a society.
Yeah.
But
I'd really say to anyone, whether they're an artist or writer or it doesn't matter what their talent or their passion is, that should always come first. Mm. And the people... I think who are the happiest, of course, the people who are doing what they feel most passionate about. And the monetary side should be a kind of second. I mean, we've all met enough people who are earning $1 million a year, but they're not the happiest people, really.
Yeah.
I mean,
and there's some very talented artists out there that are struggling to feed themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Ross, you struggle being referred to as a gay artist, and yet you market yourself to the gay community. You're most of the attendance, I would say, at your openings would be gay men who are attracted to your work. I'm presuming they're your biggest customer base.
Well, that's true. But I, you know, my work deals with, and you know, over the last 30 years, has dealt with a diverse range of subjects and themes. And
we only see the hot guys.
Many of them, but many of them have nothing to do with my sexuality. And it's like, you know, my dentist doesn't go around saying, "Oh, you know, I'm," or is not referred to as a gay dentist, or a, you know, the butcher isn't. I'm not a gay, the gay butcher. And Michael Kirby said to me a year ago, "You stand up to these journalists and whoever is going to try and brand you with this term, a gay artist." He said, "Because you're an artist first and foremost who happens to be gay." And he said, "I never wanted to be known, and I reject the term
the gay judge."
Gay judge.
And
it's the same. It's the same thing. But
although a lot of your work, I mean, look, just, you know, peeling through, all the guys seem really hot that you draw. And all the chicks.
Well, he's not going to draw the ugly ones.
No. The guys seem hot, but the chicks always, I don't know, they've got, you know, they're
bit
always,
dull,
they're
bit plain, love.
They're looking a bit dowd. They're looking
a
little
sad. You'd have to speak to Vermeer about that.
his originals.
We're speaking with Ross Watson, and we'll come back and talk to him about his new book, which is about to be launched here in Australia very shortly. You're with Dean Beck and Zoe Hart.
From Melbourne's Joy 94.9, nationally on the Community Radio Network, this is Word for Word.
Our special guest on Word for Word is Ross Watson, an amazing painter, as we have established, but this book that he's bringing out, Untitled. What's the hash for?
Well, the title of the book came from, if you look at the titles of almost all of my paintings for the last, say, 10 years, Untitled, they begin with Untitled, because I've never been interested in,
being creative with names.
Well, you see so many artworks which it might, you know, the title might be Girl in a Red Cape or whatever it is, and that's what you're looking at. So that seems a little bit pointless to me. And so much of my work is quite deliberate that, or intended that, people can come away with a number of different interpretations or thoughts about that work. So I don't want to set out to sort of just define
Ross,
the work in the title.
My goodness, is
you're deliberately the apple cart here, because for years art resellers have been able to spin bullshit after bullshit about where the title came from and where the emotion was drawn from and what the backstory is. You've just thrown all that
started
out the window.
To give intelligence to audiences, my goodness me. What
perhaps,
are we next?
And perhaps leave it to them to make their own mind.
That'd be outrageous. Now, I wanted to know, Stephen, you have to, you know, live with this, you know, this artist and his swings of up and down, and I haven't got the... Does he send you out for paint and things like that?
No, he looks after all that.
Oh, he looks at all himself, can trust you. He can trust you with all the paintings, thousands of dollars worth of paintings, but no, not quite the right colour. What I wanted to know, seriously, was what have you got on your walls at home? What is it that, you know, inspires you or speaks to you?
Well, Stephen and I have a great passion for Indigenous art, and we've collected a number of paintings and barks and from Papunyatula up in
Alice Springs, and then Jurawan Arts up in the Kimberley.
So there's a wonderful gallery called the Our Land Gallery. If you ever get back up to Kununurra, the tiny little place,
okay,
definitely worth popping in there.
Yeah,
if you're into your Aboriginal art.
Yeah.
Does it sadden you the amount of copies, rip-offs, false Aboriginal art that seems to be out there?
It does sadden me.
How can...
It's very unfortunate. There are, you know, this is this new resale royalty that the government introduced. This is something that will address or help in that problem, because there have been a lot of dealers and you know, carpetbaggers, as some of them are commonly referred to, that, you know, they'll literally give a slab of beer to the artist for a painting, and then, you know, it ends up on a gallery wall in Melbourne or in Sydney for selling for $10,000.
Yeah.
It's not right. It's morally bankrupt that continues to go on. But
and that there's collectors willing to buy those works as well.
And how
that's the other thing, because there are reputable galleries, and it's not difficult to, if everyone just does a little bit of research and is careful about which art galleries they purchase from. I certainly advise that.
How else, I mean, being an artist and being involved in the logistics of protecting and distributing your artwork, is there anything else that you can think of that might assist in us protecting those Aboriginal art, you know, pieces, or the artists, I suppose, the artist integrity and work? When you have tourists who come over and they don't know which galleries are which galleries, they just turn up, they authentically would like a piece of Aboriginal art, for maybe all the right reasons, because it speaks to them, or they just want to take something back or put something back. What could you suggest as an artist that
Well, there are like co-ops, like Papunyatula, which is run by and owned by Aboriginal artists in Alice Springs. You know, you can buy directly from them. And they have a wonderful website where works are available. And they have an annual exhibition. When is it, Stephen? End of November.
Coming up.
We've been up for that. And collectors fly in from all around Australia, and they actually put paper over the glass panel so you can't see into the gallery.
Right.
And everybody, we joined this queue. I couldn't believe it. And at whatever it was, 3 or 4 in the afternoon, they opened the door and there was a queue of about 20 of us, and you could just buy one painting each, and they were less expensive than if they were at the galleries in Melbourne or Sydney that represent Papunyatula's work. And we were very fortunate to be able to buy a painting by Yokuchi, who'd been the year before featured at in the Primavera exhibition at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And it was an extraordinary experience, because we got to meet a number of the artists, like Doreen Reed Nakamura, who sadly has died since then. It was a really wonderful 3 days that we had up there.
And that show sold out in 5 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ross Watson, Stephen Morgan, thank you both for joining us on Word for Word. Untitled, Ross Watson, the book published by Bruno Gamunda. And you can check out more information from Ross's website, rosswatson.com.
That's it. Now, the full details are at rosswatson.com.
Okay.
And there are a limited number of first edition signed copies of the book available at the book launch and exhibition, and people are also purchasing them directly at rosswatson.com.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
Check it out.
I'll be there.
Zoe Hart, thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's been delicious.
That's it for another week. We'll catch you next week. Bye for now.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Briley and presented by Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9. Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation and is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network.
service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.